3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers, and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Clap your hands.
Good morning and welcome to Thursday Breakfast. It is 7:01 in the morning, quite early for some and quite late for some based on the people that I see awake in the morning when I wake up. I'm like, you've been awake for hours and it's only 6 a.m. People in their sports gear on the street, I'm always like, why would you do it if you had the choice? No, just joking. I love getting up to come into Thursday Breakfast. And I'm very happy to be in the studio with Inez and Kate. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How special to already be in June and be celebrating June at 3CR, because what's happening at 3CR, guys?
Well, two big things this month. 3CR's 50th birthday, which is all year round we're celebrating, actually, because how can you even fit 50 years worth of celebration into 1 year? And it's also Radiothon next week.
Woohoo! Jingle, jingle. Woo-hoo! Of coins and birthday presents.
And applause.
Yes.
And a little quick shout out to my dad, whose birthday it also is today. So happy birthday!
Happy birthday, yes, Kate's
another
dad.
Special birthday.
And happy birthday to the radio station.
Well, we have an incredible show to really commemorate the first week of June, and also we'll be doing that all throughout June, but Lily, do you want to talk about what we have on first?
Yeah, so first of all, today, in honour of the 50th year on air, we will hear a compilation of 3CR's 2002 special broadcast covering 3 days of Pine Gap Peace Camp protests. In this segment, you'll hear information and analysis, really amazing analysis, from the hosts at 3CR alongside live crossovers to participants stationed at the protests outside Pine Gap near Empantwe, Alice Springs in the Northern Territory. This broadcast included the voices of Jackie, Meredith, Michael, Brad, Anthony, Rob Heller, Dimity Hawkins, Kath Keeney, Bruce Thompson, Rob Galland, Sina, James McKenzie, Kerry Nettle, Hannah Middleton, Matt Skellen, Dave Sweeney, Nick, and Rivka Nizim. And that will be complemented by authentic vintage 3CR CSAs and music, and provide some of the context for our live interview that we have on Pine Gap coming up later this morning. And after that, we are going to hear from an artist, Raju Rage, who actually spoke with me yesterday about their upcoming project in collaboration with local artist Texter Queen, who you might have heard from on 3CR before. From the Margins, Creative Survival Within Marginalised Economies will take the form of a facilitated creative workshop that uses an oversized reimagining of Snakes and Ladders to explore the lived realities of vulnerable and underrepresented artists. The facilitators, Raju and Texter, will collaborate with participants through gameplay, discussion, and shared reflection to map how challenges and opportunities intersect, and share resources and tactics, and reflect on the broader impact of navigating marginalised economies.
Next up on the show, we're speaking with Madeline Howell, who is a lawyer with the Human Rights Centre, Human Rights Law Centre, and she's working within the centre's whistleblower project. The project is Australia's first dedicated legal service established to protect and empower whistleblowers. Madeline will talk us through some shortcomings in the NDIS whistleblowing protections, as well as barriers to making complaints that were found within the Disability Royal Commission. And then she'll also let us know about some recent changes that have been made to protections long advocated for by the Human Rights Law Centre.
Yeah, amazing. And then we will hear from Anna, who's the organiser for Mapantwe for Palestine, one of the groups that is putting on the Close Pine Gap, the Sacred Land Back Convergence. It's an event inviting individuals and groups from peace and anti-militarism movements around the continent to converge on Arundelands this July 18th to 20th for 3 days of workshops, panels and actions weaving together threads of anti-militarism and decolonial movements. We know that Pine Gap has built on stolen sacred land, and the facility's involvement in war crimes and surveillance and genocide makes us also complicit in the crimes of the US. And then lastly, we have Christine Carolyn, who joins us again from Save Community Health, on the latest breaking news from CoHealth, the release of the long-awaited government-funded review of CoHealth report that came in last night. There is, you know, quite heavily financial reductions, and we'll be providing a brief update on, I guess, the contents of the report and some recommendations that have been outlined by the government for CoHealth. And then later, after Radiothon next week, we will have a more in-depth discussion and also, time to go over a lot of these reports. We have a really incredible show on today, and thank you so much for spending your morning with us, and we'll be right back with the headlines.
Hi, my name's Fionn. I'm from VALID, the Victorian Advocacy League for Individuals with Disability. We're the leading advocacy organisation for people with intellectual disability in Victoria. We're holding our annual winter conference called Advocacy in Action on the 22nd and 23rd of June at the Novotel in Bell Street, Preston. Advocacy in Action will have a strong focus on the NDIS and the changes being pushed by the federal government, which are causing huge concern for people with disabilities and their families and supporters. Advocacy in Action will involve 2 days of discussion, sharing information and planning action to make sure any changes to the NDIS are safe and positive for people with disabilities. Please come and join us. You can find out more at our website at VALID, V-A-L-I-D, .org.au.
Good morning. You're listening to 3CR 855 AM. It is 7:08, and these are the news headlines for Thursday, the 4th of June. Thousands of residents in Beirut's southern suburbs have again been forced to flee their homes after Israel threatened attacks on the Lebanese capital, despite a so-called ceasefire in place since April that Israel has frequently broken. Israel has intensified ground and airstrikes and issued forced evacuation orders across parts of Lebanon, with the escalation in their attacks displacing families who had only recently begun returning home.
Also in news this week, Palestinian health officials say at least 119 people were killed in May due to Israel's continued bombardment in Gaza, marking the highest monthly death toll so far this year. 11 new Israeli violations of the ceasefire agreement were recorded in a 24-hour period this week, as Israel continues to restrict the flow of aid and seize Palestinian territory, moving towards occupation of 70% of Gaza.
Also in headlines, a government-backed group born out of the Education Anti-Semitism Task Force was announced this week to align research grant decisions with much-criticised new hate speech laws. The pro-Israel working group, chaired by the Australian Research Council Board head, will develop a framework for grant bodies to guide compliance with the laws, raising concerns among academics about political interference in funding decisions that will lead to self-censorship of grant recipients and targeting of critics of Israel.
In other news, public housing residents and advocates continue to condemn the state Labor government's response to parliamentary inquiry into plans to demolish public housing flats in Naam. The Allan government announced this week that they reject most of the inquiry's recommendations, including calls to halt demolitions until condition reports, feasibility studies and cost-benefit analysis are released. More than 300 people rallied in the city this week, criticising the state government's lack of transparency and the proposed multi-billion dollar mass demolition and privatisation of public housing land.
Also in news this week, the Community and Public Sector Union and Anti-Poverty Centre say the federal government's $312 million employment services overhaul will fail to address fundamental problems in a broken system. The government claims it's the biggest shake-up of employment services in 30 years, but critics note that the reforms retain punitive mutual obligations and continue reliance on private providers, despite recommendations from a 2023 parliamentary inquiry to re-establish a public employment service.
And finally, in headlines, Uncle Robbie Thorpe has continued a decades-long legal campaign in the State Court of Appeal, seeking to pursue charges against King Charles over the genocide of First Nations peoples. The court heard an application to overturn a previous ruling that blocked the case, with supporters gathering outside the courthouse on Mabo Day yesterday, as Uncle Robbie argued that genocide laws should apply to Crown representatives in so-called Australia. In a statement, Uncle Robbie said, quote, "Genocide is a crime, not just globally, but right here in our backyard. This nation cannot claim to be civilised if it allows genocide to continue unchecked, generation after generation," end quote. These have been the news headlines for Thursday, the 4th of June. You're listening to 3CR on 855 AM.
We're celebrating 50 years of 3CR on Saturday, the 4th of July at Collingwood Town Hall. There'll be stalls, displays, great food, performances, activities, prizes, and so much more. It's a birthday for us, and we can't wait to celebrate with you. Saturday, the 4th of July, Collingwood Town Hall, 11 a.m. till 4 p.m. Bring your family, tell your friends, all are welcome. 3CR, celebrating 50 years.
Let us know you're coming. Go to Humanitix and search for 3CR to RSVP.
And now we are going to a segment in honour of 3CR's 50th birthday this year that we're celebrating. And I just wanted to remind people that if you are one of those lucky people that's been listening to 3CR for 50 years, which is at least 20 years longer than I've been alive, I really encourage you to donate to our Radiothon this month so we can stay independent and keep creating amazing community-led content. And you can do that by calling the station on 9419 8377, or you can SMS 0488 809 855, or you can go to givenow.com.au/CR/3CR Breakfast 2026, and that's for our breakfast shows here. And if you really love what Thursday Breakfast does in particular, you can nominate us as the show that you'd like to dedicate your donation to. I really enjoyed actually editing this segment. It is a compilation of 3CR's 2002 special. I can't even do the maths how long ago that was. It was a long time, a long, long time ago. But yeah, people have been out advocating for this cause for so long. And it was interesting to hear that that was just the start of people getting to know about Pine Gap, know that it actually existed. So this is the 2002 special broadcast covering 3 days of Pine Gap Peace Camp protests. And in this segment, you'll hear information and analysis from the 3CR hosts alongside live crossovers to participants stationed at the protests outside Pine Gap near Impantwe, Alice Springs in the Northern Territory. And there was a lot of contributors in this segment over the 3 days, including volunteers from 3CR and protesters themselves. And their voices are complemented in this segment by authentic vintage 3CR CSAs and some music. So here you go. I hope you enjoy.
You're listening to 3CR, and I'm eating banana, which is not very professional broadcasting of me.
You're listening to 3CR.
Pine Gap is a big secret US spy base here in Australia, about 20 kilometres from Alice Springs in the West Macdonald Ranges. It's been around since 1968, and there's been protests all over the decades, really, around Pine Gap. And I guess it's particularly pertinent at the moment because it looks like the US might be going to bomb Iraq again. And, of course, there's a lot of spy tracking of missile actions that go on directly from Pine Gap here in Australia. So that makes us all pretty implicit, doesn't it?
It certainly does. We thought before we go to any more live crosses to find out what's been happening, we might just hear a bit about what Jackie's just been talking about, the background to Pine Gap and what it does and what its functions are. This is an interview that Rob Heller and myself from the Strike Back program recorded earlier this morning with Dimity Hawkins, and she's been one of the key organisers of the Pine Gap protest this weekend, working both with Friends of the Earth Australia and the Medical Association for the Prevention of War.
Well, there's so many issues about Pine Gap, and Pine Gap's been around for a long time. It was established in the late 1960s as a CIA intelligence base, and it's been active in so much US war fighting in that time, since that time, including things like the Gulf War, etc. So at the moment, of course, one of the great concerns is the role that Pine Gap is playing in the war on Afghanistan that's been raging now for just about a year. And we've been involved in that, of course, both by having troops on the ground, but also by having facilities like Pine Gap in use. But also the upcoming war against Iraq is of great concern to a lot of people, and Pine Gap is absolutely integral to any war against Iraq. And will be used in that.
Do we know much about how it's used? What like when you say it's integral to those kind of wars, what does it do?
Well, this is part of the problem. For a long time, we haven't known very much about Pine Gap at all, and that's why we started up this campaign to expose the gap, and to expose exactly what goes on there. We wanted to start doing that, not just through direct action, but through asking questions in Parliament, through doing, you know, inspiring a few journalists to do a bit of investigation, by doing a whole lot of things. And some of the things that Pine Gap does, what Pine Gap has been, what it was set up for was to be a CIA intelligence base. And basically over the years, as technology has advanced, as people have learned, as the US military particularly have been increasing the amounts of satellites that they've been putting into space, and they've been able to track a lot more military personnel, military movements. They've been able to do a lot more surveillance. They've been able to survey people's phones, backs, blah, 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 blah. All of those things have happened from space, from satellite technology. And Pine Gap has been integral to that for the whole Southern Hemisphere region. So our entire region, not just Australia, but our whole, all our neighbours, all the Southern Hemisphere has been monitored by the Pine Gap base. Now, as the US military are increasing their militarization of space, we are looking at a greater risk of Pine Gap becoming integral to things like the missile defense system, which the US military are wanting to set up. And that system means that they will be able to dominate space militarily. And that also means that they'll be able to shoot weapons from space, they'll be able to target weapons from space, they'll be able to do a whole lot of stuff from off the ground, basically. So they're looking at making, the US military are looking at making space a fourth dimension of warfare, and that's what Pine Gap will be involved in, and we want to stop that.
On the phone now we've got Rivka, who's part of the police liaison out at Pine Gap at the moment. Rivka, are you there?
Hi, how are you going?
I'm not too bad, thanks.
So maybe just, can you just describe for us, what's it like where you are? Can you try and describe what the facility looks like, what it's like in that part of the desert where you are? How does it feel to be there?
Oh, it's incredibly hot. It's great. It's we've got a huge field about 7 or 8 kilometres from Pine Gap, from the actual gates of the facility. And this area was chosen because apparently there's all sorts of plants around this area that are really not very nice to sit on or camp on. And this is one of the clearest areas that the organisers could find. So it's a huge big field by the side of the road, and there's tents and stuff dotted all over the place. There's a big kitchen area, and the kitchen people have just made huge serves of pakoras that people have been devouring. And there's a couple of other big shade spaces set up. The Creative Futures Collective's got a big shade space, and there's a couple of teepees. There's a teepee for all the kids. And people are just kind of winding down after a really hot, full-on day. And the temperature's dropping a bit. There's a bit of a breeze. And all around us are these beautiful mountains. If anyone's ever been up to Alice Springs, you'll know that it's all surrounded by the McDonnell Ranges, and we can see them from here. And the sky is incredibly clear, amazing sky full of stars last night. And it's really, really nice to be up here.
Excuse me. How many people are up there?
About 300.
Okay.
And a whole lot of locals came down to support the protest today as well, which was really nice.
Awesome. And how many police would you say were?
Oh, God. there would have been a couple of hundred at least.
Too many. And
Yeah, and they really stuck it out. For the last couple of hours, there's been maybe a handful of people that stayed up at the gates.
Yep.
And the police kept their three lines in front of the gates in formation for something like 5 hours. For half a dozen protesters who were just kind of hanging around and playing music.
And as for John Howard and all the other government representatives saying we're un-Australian, I contest that. I feel really shame that we are being told we're not Australian. We are the Indigenous people here. We're the ones who've had foreign laws applied to our traditional law. The law of this land is respect the earth, respect other people and don't steal. And I'm sick of negotiating.
Put some clouds block out the sun.
The militarisation of Australia's desert has been a really long process that you have highlighted on this station many a time. But once more, could you talk a little bit about the cycle of the nuclear industry in that part of Australia?
Yeah, sure. There's been about 50 years of, I guess, basically other countries coming over here and using it as a service facility. Just down the road from Pine Gap, a couple of hundred k's, is the test sites for the Maralinga and Emu Field nuclear weapons tests taken by the British. Last Thursday was the 50th anniversary of the first atomic weapons test on Australian soil. So this region has seen 50 years of an exploitation for a nuclear pursuit that was always, as everybody knows about the nuclear industry, was driven from the start by military desires and remains intimately linked with that system.
Fantastic. So, and also, of course, the dispossession of Indigenous people. I read yesterday that, you know, only 1 year after Indigenous people were given the vote, the facility was set up. So in 67, they were given the vote in this country, and then in 68, Pine Gap was, that land was taken off them and, turned over to America.
For 3 days from Saturday the 5th of October, 3CR will bring you special programming from Pine Gap, the US military surveillance base in South Australia. Tune in at 5:30pm Saturday, 11am and 6pm Sunday and 9am Monday for live crosses to people at the base who are saying to the United States, we don't want to take part in directing your weapons, we don't want to help you dominate space, and we don't want to be a nuclear target because of your presence. Exposing the Gap, Saturday the 5th to Monday the 7th of October on 3CR, Radio Without Borders.
There isn't a lot of support within the Australian community either for the idea of us going to war, and there is a lot of anger about the way that Australia is allowing itself to be used as a kind of an outpost, an American outpost, and the Alice Springs community and the Indigenous locals there are incredibly implicated in that, and of course people in that local area are going to be really angry about this top secret base, which no one actually is, there's no information given to the general public about what is actually going on there and how much it is putting the Australian public at risk.
Yeah, interesting that Senator Hill has said in the last month that it would be the Pine Gap facility would be integral in any attacks that take place in Iraq. They were also integral in how things were played out in the Afghani strikes. So this is real. This is, an Australian/American facility being heavily involved in really violent and damaging action to civilians and the environment and all of those factors. And not only that, this is a spy facility. So it is actually, every time you mention anything that goes through a satellite that has the word bomb in it or, some sort of
terrorism
keyword.
Definitely the keyword of the moment.
You begin to be taped. So we would be, if we're using a satellite, which we are now, to broadcast And if you use a mobile phone or a long-distance phone call, the internet, all of those things go through satellites, and this base can actually track and record and, you know, put into its databases all of this information, including all of the things that are said and your name, probably, you know, further information along those lines, like the location of where the call is coming from and going to. So this isn't little, you know, this mm-hmm. is huge mm-hmm. what this facility does.
From Saturday, October 5th, 3CR will cover 3 days of action for peace at the US spy base at Pine Gap. People from around the country are gathering to protest against global militarism and Australia's role in it.
Thank you very much for listening to special programming, 3CR broadcast from Pine Gap. And thank you very much, Emily Hayes.
And Petra Watson.
This is Thursday Breakfast, and in honour of our 50th year on air, you just heard a compilation of 3CR's 2002 special broadcast covering 3 days of Pine Gap Peace Camp protests, and also some very special 2002 CSAs and 3CR music. The broadcast included the voices of many volunteers and 3CR presenters giving information and analysis about the protests. And later this morning, we're going to hear another interview on the current situation at Pine Gap. So stay tuned for that. And now we hear from artist Raju Rage, who I spoke with yesterday, about their upcoming project in collaboration with local artist Texter Queen. The project, From the Margins, Creative Survival Within Marginalised Economies, will take the form of a facilitated creative workshop that uses an oversized reimagining of Snakes and Ladders to explore the lived realities of vulnerable and underrepresented artists. There will be a series of workshops, with the first being held at Arts House at 521 Queensberry Street, North Melbourne, on Thursday the 13th of August and Thursday the 20th of August from 12 to 4pm. And if you'd like to participate in that, you can submit your expression of interest before Wednesday the 10th of June, and we'll include all the details to do that in our show notes on the podcast. But now you can listen to Raju tell you all about it. So to start today, I thought maybe you could introduce yourself and the project briefly.
Sure. So I'm Raju. I'm an interdisciplinary artist and educator from the UK, and I work at the intersection of creativity, equity, and community, usually producing some sort of resource as part of the artwork. I've been working as an artist and an educator for more than 15 years now. And I have experience in art, in activism, in self and collective organized queer, transgender, global majority movements and creative projects that my practice and my politics draws from.
Yeah, thank you so much for that bit of background. So with this project in particular, it's related to a workshop. Is the project purely based around the workshop, or what actually is From the Margins?
So From the Margin is a collaboration between myself and Texter Queen, and it's trying to explore the theme of marginalized economies and creative survival within it. So what you kind of introduced, focusing on the issues of diversity and accessibility for vulnerable and underrepresented artists. And it's going to involve a residency at They Swarm, which is the peer mentoring residency space and project run by Texter Queen in Melbourne. And then there's going to be a series of workshops, a couple of workshops with the public makeshift series with Arts House Melbourne. And that's going to result in us producing some creative resources around the subject that we will then later share publicly. And this project has been funded by British Council as part of their Connections Through Culture grant program. The idea is that we collectively share our knowledge and experiences around a subject that maybe is spoken more about in private within kind of artists, you know, and creative practitioners networks, but maybe isn't spoken about so publicly, or there's a stigma around that. And just to kind of like unpack it and find strategies and resources around navigating that together, but using this gameplay as a way of entering that, because it kind of is a metaphor for how we kind of feel as, I guess, as both Texter and I as artists within the art world, is kind of like there's a kind of a gameplay to it. So we thought we'd play on that. Yeah.
Something that I've been really curious about based on looking at your past work, and I also want to mention it's really exciting to know that you're coming all the way to Wurundjeri land to be here in person to facilitate this project. I'm wondering what relational experiences or part of your journey as an artist or just as a human in relationship led you to the work of this project.
So personally, I've witnessed and experienced systemic barriers in, you know, with ableism, with racism, you know, other fuckery or other unstable support, you know, in my career as well as peers. And yeah, just kind of feel like it's there in every negotiation, every conversation with an organization or institution that kind of shapes day-to-day kind of, yeah, working and career as an artist. And sometimes it can get in the way of actually making the work. And I think that's something that bothers me and bothers a lot of artists, that we want to be creative. We want to make work. We also want to make a living from our work a lot of the time, not all the time. But, you know, that comes with, you know, engaging with organizations and institutions. So, yeah, it's something that is very kind of relevant to my personal life, my practice, and seems to be like a collective issue. So, yeah, and like I said, it's spoken about more privately, maybe. People rant about it, you know, people maybe share kind of information, but I think it would be, yeah, interesting to put it out there, to speak more openly about it and to create resources around that as well. And how cultural attitudes shape marginalized economies as well, and the differences, you know, there's distinctions, but there's also connected challenges between UK and Australia as well. So, yeah, kind of around, you know, differences in funding, institutional access, cultural visibility. There's similarities but distinctions, and it would be good to really explore that together.
To get a better understanding of what is at the core of this project, the work of creative survival, all these things that you're referring to happening in private for a lot of marginalized artists, can you tell me more about the concept of marginalized economies in simple language for people that might not have heard a term like that before, yeah, but might relate to it?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So I've written a little bit about it, and I'm going to just share an extract. But yeah, quite simply put, for many marginalized artists, those of us who face exclusions and structural barriers to the arts, marginalization can take many forms. It can be growing up working class and not having language or cultural codes to navigate middle class spaces, even though you need to network in them. It could be not being able to physically enter the workplace due to lack of accessible infrastructure, limiting your ability to then participate. It could be being discriminated against for the color of your skin, which means being ignored or dismissed. It could be the extensive application process for a grant or funding that you really need or really want, and then it's like, turns out it's only for under 40s or graduate artists only. Or you have difficulty with filling in, you know, these kind of administrative processes. It could be that you are within the age range, but you were not able to go to university to study or to art school. And the options for scholarships are kind of, you know, one in a million, and it's highly competitive. So even though they say they're open to everybody, it ends up being those who are better positioned. Or it could be that you're struggling to fit into institutional, you know, jargon, like language and definitions that don't feel relevant for who you are. And it can just, yeah, it can also be things like a lot of panels are, you know, male only, you know, made up of men, and they end up choosing a guy, you know. So, yeah, I think there's many different different reasons, but it, you know, it comes down to kind of like these barriers that you face because of your positionality in the world. Yeah.
Yeah, thanks for that explanation of what exactly a marginalized economy manifests in everyday people's lives. Now, what do you hope to nurture in the upcoming workshops?
So the project itself aims to challenge these systemic barriers by generating, I guess, some form of meaningful, accessible content. So, and yeah, kind of embracing disabled artists and the accessibility that comes with that and nurturing transnational solidarity between us. And for that, yeah, it really is kind of open in the sense of we don't know what people are going to share. We don't know what's going to come up. You know, we're going to share from our personal experiences to kind of open it up between me and Texter and then see, you know, what comes from that and collaboratively in some way create some resources that we can share then publicly with the participants, but also the wider public who can also use that in some way. So the idea is to create something probably digital, something that can be shared quite widely afterwards. And the idea is to play the game, to use the game as a kind of a methodology, as a kind of a tool, I guess, to like uncover some of these underlying issues that come up for people. And so that will happen in the workshop. And then after with the residency, we'll be kind of, yeah, developing those resources afterwards as well. And I think we'll do a salon at the They Swarm and invite people to come as well. So yeah, there'll be opportunities to kind of to share within the workshop, which you have to register for, but then also outside of that also. Yeah.
I love the idea of using gameplay as a way to explore real world dynamics. I'm really curious to know a bit more about what drew you to snakes and ladders in particular as a way of exploring marginalized economies, and whether you've been interested in like gameplay as a tool for relational work in the past.
So yeah, the idea of the snakes and ladders actually came from a previous collaboration between Texter and I for their Bollywoodent series. And they did a portrait of myself, and I kind of wanted to kind of be semi anonymous. So we kind of did a mask, and I was wearing a sweatshirt that said, that was an artwork of mine that says, not your cutie pock celebrity. And Texter, and so, yeah, I think Texter and I come from similar kind of approaches to artwork, although I think they're more satirical and witty than I am. But yeah, so they had come up with this idea of the snakes and ladders to kind of draw from that kind of statement of the sweatshirt from my artwork that's kind of speaking to the critique, I guess, of how artists kind of used by the institution in terms of kind of representation. So they came up with this, they did a drawing of me in front of the Snakes and Ladders board game. And then when I was actually doing some of my own research into textiles, and I was in a museum in India, I saw the Snakes and Ladders game there in a very old, you know, textile that was framed. And I was just really intrigued by that, so I started to look into it more. And yeah, Snakes and Ladders originates from South Asia, and yeah, the original game was more kind of around this morality, but in kind of more around spiritual ascension. And then when the British colonialists came, they kind of took the game and adapted it and kind of lost that element. I think it's still somewhat like plays on morality, but it's kind of more about climbing, you know, it's kind of been flattened down and simplified a little bit and removed from that. So we were thinking that was quite interesting, because those are some of the questions like around ethics and things like that that we are also considering like some of the original kind of old, 17th century or whatever, ways of kind of playing the game kind of link more to maybe what the questions that we're also asking now. So, we thought that would be interesting, and also kind of this decolonial aspect of reclaiming it, reimagining it in our context, in this modern day context. But we just felt like it did kind of signify this idea of like playing this game within the art world that artists need to do as well. Like, and we thought, well, how can we do that, base it on that framework, but then complicate it a little bit more? And the old-fashioned version is quite, it's more complex than the modern-day kind of colonial version.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward.
Sorry, it's a very long answer, but
Oh, it's really interesting. Thank you. And I'm really looking forward to seeing how those ideas are worked through in real life in the workshop. To wrap up today, so people know what to expect if they participate in the workshop, can you explain what the day might look like and also what people need to do if they would like to participate in this workshop in August?
Sure. The workshop is open for anybody who feels like they relate to the subject and the themes to attend, but you do have to register with Arts House Melbourne in their site for the makeshift series and answer a few questions just to help us prepare for the session. But it just involves sharing their interest and connection to marginalized creative economies and what perspectives they would like to bring and share in exchange with us. I think there's 7 spots left, because we can only cap for like 12 people, and everyone will be provided with a $200 honorarium as well. And we ask that participants commit to COVID safety protocols on the day. And the day will be like a 3-hour session with breaks. And it will be in a kind of warehouse space. So there'll be like a lot of room. There'll be a kitchen there with refreshments and things like that as well. And we're going to lay out this oversized game that we're going to be creating together. And we're going to play that game. And through playing the gameplay, we're going to uncover some of these conversations and strategies. So we're going to develop the game through the day as we play. So that's kind of the basic gist. We ask participants to bring an object that symbolizes this kind of theme to them, and something that's important to them in their creative practice, and kind of use those as tokens as well to play the game.
Raju, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your wisdom.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for inviting me. I look forward to meeting you all.
You're listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. And you just heard my conversation yesterday with artist Raju Rage, who spoke with me about their upcoming project, From the Margins, in collaboration with local artist Texter Queen. If you'd like to participate in one of those workshops that Raju just described, submit your expression of interest before Wednesday, the 10th of June, at the Arts House website, and we'll include all those links on our podcast show notes.
And I don't believe in fighting today in any one front, but on all fronts. In fact, I'm a black nationalist freedom fighter.
This country is a nation of thieves.
Now, we're never going to get justice here in these filthy racist courts here.
Our people have been massacred, and we're not supposed to grieve for that. We've got to do something more drastic if we're serious about this.
Move over or we're going to move on over you.
Yilliman with Kieran Stewart-Asherton on 3CR. Dives deep into Indigenous resistance and global anti-colonial struggles. Featuring frontline activists, it confronts Australia's identity, challenges power structures, and fuels revolutionary discourse. Wednesdays, 12 to 1 PM.
ThreeCR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings. Cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
Up now, we're speaking with Madeleine Howell, a lawyer with the Human Rights Law Centre who works within the centre's whistleblower project. Thank you so much for joining us, Madeleine. It's great to have you on the show.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
I thought we could start by speaking about current whistleblower protections. So up until recently, what have been the main whistleblower protections for those wishing to speak up about issues within the NDIS?
Yeah, so there's these sort of sector-specific provisions that sit in the NDIS legislation that really reflect, I guess, the need for transparency and accountability in a scheme that is designed to look after and enrich the lives of people with disability. And so up until March, these were the most outdated whistleblower protections across the federal whistleblower protection landscape. There's 9 different whistleblowing laws at the federal level, and so the NDIS whistleblower protections have been falling drastically behind for some time. So some of the key sort of shortfalls, I guess, in the scheme is that previously whistleblowers in the NDIS who might be working for a provider and see some wrongdoing happen, after they've left the provider or if they were a participant, after they had ceased receiving services from that provider, they could no longer speak up with that and receive the protections under the scheme. Further to that, there was also really, really limited protections for their confidentiality. And there was a requirement that whistleblowers under the scheme actually had to provide their name when they made a whistleblowing disclosure. And so the reforms in March this year of the Albanese government really fixed some of those gaping holes that were preventing people from speaking up under the scheme.
Mm. And when you say that they're some of the weakest across the federal landscape of protections, like, that's really saying something, isn't it? Because, I mean, it's they're limited to begin with in general. So I'm just wondering what have been some of the consequences of these limited whistleblower protections.
Yeah, so I think really what the consequences are twofold. You have individual whistleblowers under the scheme are bearing the burden of speaking up about wrongdoing in the NDIS. So in recent years, there's been a lot of public interest journalism that's played a key role in revealing really concerning treatment of people with disability, as well as fraud and misconduct and other kinds of wrongdoing under the scheme. And what happens there is the risk goes entirely to the whistleblower who has to decide, you know, this is something that's important to me for this information to come to light, so I'm going to speak up about it at great personal cost. Or you have people who actually choose to remain silent because the risk is too high, or, you know, they are concerned about losing their job and they think, well, you know, hopefully someone else will speak up about it.
Mm. So we end up, you know, not having limited information and having a real grasp of what's actually, you know, going on. Yeah, very sad. The Disability Royal Commission found that complaint mechanisms under the NDIS were complex and inaccessible. I was just wondering if you could sort of break down what they meant by this.
Sure. So I think whistleblower protections are sort of one facet of the broader complaints and reporting infrastructure of the NDIS, but they're a really crucial aspect in ensuring that those within the scheme who are sort of close to the source of where the wrongdoing has happened can speak up. And so the Disability Royal Commission looked at the shortcomings of the complaint mechanism broadly, and there were a few sort of, I guess, key findings. One of them was that there really are such high barriers to reporting for people under the scheme, and that's because of the complexity of the existing complaints landscape, which is really difficult to participate in without appropriate assistance and support. It also found that organisations don't really have strong and robust complaint handling systems, which what that means in practice is that often complaints and reports don't make it past the sort of internal reporting mechanism because they're not dealt with appropriately within organisations.
Mm-hmm.
And it also found that there was sort of a lack of national consistency between states and territories and the Commonwealth, and that the referral pathways between regulators was too limited to be able to appropriately deal with the wrongdoing that was being that's being reported under the scheme.
Some real barriers there. In March of this year, the Human Rights Law Centre did have a win with the Albanese government, as you'd previously mentioned, adopting some of the centre's suggested reforms for whistleblower protections within the NDIS. What has been implemented as a result?
Yeah, so the key changes that we saw in March can sort of be summarised around sort of three key points, I think. Firstly, that now whistleblowers with, I guess, a former connection to an organisation, whether that's because they're a former employee, contractor or participant, can now blow the whistle and be protected. There's stronger protections for a whistleblower's confidentiality, which match the protections in the broader private sector regime in the Corporations Act. And it also removed the requirement to provide your name or identity when you make a disclosure. And thirdly, it removed some of the more archaic old requirements around blowing the whistle, including the good faith requirement, which really used to sort of put the emphasis or obligation on the whistleblower and their intentions for speaking up rather than the public interest purpose in people disclosing information about wrongdoing. I think it's important to note that these reforms, we're really encouraged to see these reforms and, you know, sort of moving towards what we've been calling for a long time. But these are really a first step. The NDIS whistleblower protection regime still remains behind other federal whistleblowing laws and behind best practice more broadly. And there's really no reason why whistleblowers in the NDIS should have weaker protections than whistleblowers in other private sector industries. So we're encouraged to see these reforms, but certainly urge the government to go further.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you say that they're a first step, what more do you feel could be done to assist with people wanting to speak up about issues within the NDIS?
So I think one of the key problems that we have is the inconsistency and sort of disharmonisation across the board. Across private sector whistleblower protections, you have a lot of inconsistency in the protections that are afforded to whistleblowers depending on which law applies to them. In the short term, we really want to see NDIS whistleblower protections harmonised with other private sector protections. So what are the key missing pieces at the moment? Whistleblowers in the NDIS sector still cannot be protected to make a disclosure to a lawyer, a medical professional or an independent advocate to receive advice and information about and assistance about the process of whistleblowing and accessing their rights under the scheme. Another missing piece is that NDIS whistleblowers don't have this sort of external disclosure, public interest journalism pathway that we have in other whistleblowing laws, where if NDIS whistleblower makes a disclosure through the regulatory pathways and nothing happens for whatever reason, it's not investigated, under other regimes, they would be able to make a disclosure to a journalist and be protected. That's not the case under the NDIS legislation. And I guess in the long term, what we need to see is a consistent approach to reforming protections at the federal level. We've had a disharmonised scheme for some time now, and it's bad for whistleblowers who have to navigate a complex regulatory environment, a complex scheme. And it's also bad for business who have an increased regulatory burden of complying with one or more whistleblowing laws that are inconsistent with each other.
Some of the disparities of what you've just pointed out are really, really, you know, we were just sitting here sort of shaking our heads listening to it. It was, yeah. Wow. And I thought to wrap up, Madeline, what would be some advice you may have to someone who is wishing to make a complaint or speak up about issues within the NDIS?
So the best thing that you can do to prevent adverse results from speaking up is to get legal advice early. Of course, the lawyer would say that, but it really, you know, we see much better outcomes when people can come to us before they've done anything, before they've blown the whistle, before they've considered speaking up, and we can give advice about how to navigate those laws in a way that sort of prevents retaliation or harm for doing so. Of course, you know, whistleblowing remains a tough gig in Australia and we're working really hard to change those laws, but there are sort of practical steps that can be taken to, you know, prevent harm, and making sure you have adequate supports around you can help do that. The Whistleblower Project is a pro bono service, and we advise whistleblowers across the public and private sectors across all jurisdictions in Australia. So you can jump onto our website, make a request inquiry for assistance, and we might be able to give you some legal advice about blowing the whistle.
Amazing. And we can provide the links in our show notes to that project as well. And thank you so much for coming on the show, Madeline. It's been really great speaking with you.
Thanks so much.
That was Madeline Howell speaking to us from the Human Rights Law Centre, where she works within the centre's whistleblower project, which we will provide the links to in our show notes if anyone is wanting to access information on that. She spoke us through some of the shortcomings of sort of recent protections that have been in place and barriers that have been in place to making complaints that were found within the Disability Royal Commission, and also recent changes that have been made that have been long advocated for by the Human Rights Law Centre.
Women on the Line, a radical intersectional current affairs program.
Making space for the voices of women and gender diverse people.
Featuring in-depth conversations with guests from SoCourt Australia and beyond.
Ultimately, we're looking to care for country, to continue our culture, to continue our ceremonies, so that our children have a strong sense of self and belonging.
Just because our marginalisation intersect where we're both disabled, it doesn't change your white privilege. It doesn't change your straight privilege. It doesn't change your able-bodied privilege.
Sex work, the word itself, has been such a word with a lot of stigma. However, we cannot ignore that there are women out there who are making their livelihood out of this job.
Listen every Monday morning at 8:30 on 3CR Community Radio 855 AM or stream live on 3cr.org.au.
Love podcasts? We've got you. Find Women on the Line via the Community Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Women on the Line, we're about
feminisms in their multitudes,
First Nations sovereignty,
land back,
trans liberation, poo-poo on the turfs,
abolition,
anti-racism,
sex worker rights,
South liberation,
disability justice,
anti-imperialism,
decolonisation,
an end to borders,
workers' justice,
and so much more.
Women on the Line, broadcasting on the 3CR airwaves since 1986.
Woo! Woo!
3CR, celebrating 50 years.
Throughout the month of June, we're asking you to support fierce, independent and community-controlled media by making a donation to our Radiothon.
We'll be taking donations online, over the phone and in the station to help keep 3CR going for another year.
To donate, go to 3cr.org.au, call the station on 03 94 19 8377,
or drop in at 21 Smith Street, Fitzroy, during business hours.
3CR, celebrating 50 years.
Welcome back to 3CR Thursday Breakfast. It is the 4th of June and it is Radiothon month. Our Radiothon show is next week on the 11th of June, and it's also 50 years. So in honour of 50 years for the first week, we just heard protest archival footage from the 2002 special live broadcast from Pine Gap Peace Camp protest. And then we heard from Raju Rage about an incredible collaboration project with Texter. And we also heard from the Human Rights Law Centre and the Whistleblower Project for the NDIS. And now, following the archival footage, we are joined by Anna, who is an organiser with Mempatwe for Palestine, one of the groups pulling on the Close the Pine Gap, the Sacred Land Back Convergence. And the event is inviting individuals and groups about anti-militarism movements and peace around the continent to come to Iron Islands this July the 18th to the 20th. Thank you so much, Anna, for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
Could you tell us more about Pine Gap? We heard a little bit about it in the archival footage, which is pretty amazing, but why has it been a vital site of protest for decades?
Okay, so Pine Gap, it is a joint US-Australian surveillance base, and it's located 17 kilometres southeast of Alice Springs and Bantwa on Kuyunba, a parcel of sacred land, land sacred to Central Aranda people. And the facility is regarded as the most strategic, important US foreign base, of which the US has over 800 around the world.
So Pine Gap, just to reiterate, Pine Gap is the most important US base?
Yes. Yeah, it's considered as such.
Wow, I did not know that. That is pretty outstanding, seeing as you said that we're over, 800?
Yeah.
Okay, so very, very important.
Yeah, it is. And I'll try and impress why that is. So it's a node in a network of surveillance infrastructure, a very important node. And what it does, okay, this can be kind of difficult to impress verbally. It really benefits from some diagrams, but I'll do my best. One of its main functions is a satellite ground station. So to set the scene, listeners might be familiar with Pine Gap's notorious golf ball skyline.
Mm-hmm.
Those golf balls are huge white rayer domes which house enormous antennas, kind of satellite dishes within those domes, the largest of which spans 100 metres, so really big we're talking. And these antennas receive signals intelligence from satellites in orbit over Indonesia and the Indian Ocean. And that intelligence has been intercepted from civilian and military communications in areas of interest. And that creates this triangulation of data. So you have the point of interception of that signals intelligence, the satellite in orbit, and then the antenna receiving that intelligence in the Pine Gap facility. And that is then kind of decrypted and aggregated into really important information, targeting drone strikes, for example, which is, crucial information for modern warfare and the many wars of belligerence that Australia and the US has been involved with in the Middle East over the past 20 years. So the kind of coverage arc that's achieved through this constellation spans half the globe, from far eastern Russia to far western Africa and the whole longitude in between, which makes up for what the US can't kind of achieve with the same setup in their own territory.
Yeah, thank you so much for explaining that. Yeah, also in the studio, we're all mouths agape. Even though we hear a lot about Close Pine Gap on our show and across 3CR, the actual intricacies of how far-reaching and geographically advantageous it is really outstanding. And speaking of the Australia's complicity, particularly with the AUKUS alliance, why is it important to close Pine Gap, and particularly now with how important Pine Gap is to Australia's so-called wars defence?
Yeah, so-called defence, for sure. Nowadays we do have a very clear picture of what Pine Gap does, and it is unconscionable to continue to host that installation. The information that's gathered at Pine Gap has been completely crucial to these wars of aggression, which have killed over 1 million civilians, which is just an astronomical figure that's really hard to actually, conceive of the human toll to that. And, there's just no justifying its continuation. And custodians of the land never consented to Pine Gap being stationed on their land, Kuyunba. And they feel a great sadness knowing that such violence and such senseless destruction of life is being committed from their land. They also feel a great sadness being unable to access sacred sites within the perimeter of the facility. And so they really want to highlight that this space has secure tenure without their permission, while they themselves are relegated to insecure tenure in housing in what gets called town camps, which lack access to the most basic of amenities, such as running water and electricity.
Yeah.
So custodians want this convergence to make this reality really clear to people around the continent, and they want to educate visitors about the plight that their people face, as well as the role of Pine Gap, what it's responsible for.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's so important, and I know it's really highlighted in the Close Pine Gap, the convergence information as well, how important it is to make sure that we never forget that it is on sacred land, and the First Nations people have been fighting for forever to say Close Pine Gap. And I know with the convergence and helping organise it, can you walk us through a bit of the program and what are some of the core themes for the sessions?
Sure. Yes, so Mbantwa for Palestine have been working together with AMAN, Anti-Militarism Action Network. That's a kind of national network to put together a program, and with traditional owners as well. And we're really excited about it. So the broad sweep of things is that we'll have 2 days of workshops and panels and 1 day of action, and in between plenty of downtime, time to socialise and mingle. And yeah, while we're finalising the program, we have released 2 rounds of announcements on the morning plenaries. So we'll be kicking off day one with a welcome to country, followed by a panel on colonialism and imperialism, struggles here and abroad. And on that panel, we have Professor Catherine Gilby and Aliwa Alhera, academic specialising in Indigenous knowledge, inclusive education and critical race theory. And she's just such an animated and knowledgeable speaker who will undoubtedly speak very clearly and strongly to the nefarious impacts of the Northern Territory intervention, which are still plaguing Aboriginal communities in the NT. Catherine will be in conversation with Rima Naji, a Palestinian activist with Justice for Palestine Maganjan, who has played a leading role in organising against Israel's genocide against the people of Palestine. And Ahmed Adam, a Sudanese artist and writer whose work investigates the connections between global capital, digital infrastructure and the violence of militias such as the Rapid Support Forces in Sudan. Ahmed spent 12 years living in Mbantwa and so is particularly well placed to draw out these global threads of colonialism and imperialism. And then we're lucky to have Professor Amy Maguire, proud Darumbul and South Sea Islander academic and journalist, who will facilitate a very generative conversation between these thinkers. And then day two, we're going to have a look into the Australia-US alliance with a powerhouse panel featuring Auntie Sue Hazeldine, who is a Gugatha woman from Sejuna in South Australia. She's the president of the Australian Nuclear Free Alliance, ANFA, and is currently fighting the Southern Launch installation. She'll be in conversation with Rita Jabri Markwell, a lawyer of Lebanese descent based in Sydney, specialising in human rights and public interest litigation. And Karina Lester, Anangu woman from the Yankunit Jepjara land, who carries the legacy of her father, the late Yankunit Jepjara elder Yami Lester, who was blinded in the 1953 nuclear test at Emu Fields in South Australia. And these three staunch women will be joined by New South Wales Green Senator David Shoebridge to discuss why we need to break ties with the US. Which is, you know, a crucial part of the programming, as it's kind of on everyone's lips. It's really time to cut ties with the US, they're ramping up belligerence against China, who are our regional neighbour and number one trading partner, and, you know, the AUKUS alliance, which you mentioned earlier, is just a huge escalation in that. And it really, we want to be unequivocal in Umbantu for Palestine that the only credible reason Australia might be attacked by foreign military is because of citing US military installations on this continent, installations which are used in war, to which Australia is not a party, and which will be used in the event of a US war on China.
Yeah, thank you so much for going through the program and how important it is that local and national issues that are impacting First Nations people are in the Northern Territory are so highlighted, because that is so important. So, as you said, the convergence is a sacred land back, and how to break Australia's ties in the genocidal war and US imperialism. And going through the program, maybe people have attended conferences before. How do you think that this convergence is similar or dissimilar to a conference somebody else might have attended? And what do you hope that people really come away with after attending?
Yeah, well, I guess we want this convergence to be an action-oriented convergence. We want to bring together people who have been actively working against militarism, actively in solidarity with Palestine, to come together and kind of fortify their relationships and create a really strong network of people on this continent who are fighting that, because we recognise there's been an enormous groundswell of grassroots activity around these issues for the past few years. And in order for that to continue to grow and become stronger, more directed, more strategic, we figure coming together and strategizing and forming these indispensable relationships is a really good way to do that. So the program is designed with that in mind, first and foremost, and we want people to come away with stronger networks and stronger relationships with one another. Yeah,
amazing. It's so wonderful, even throughout the program and our conversation today, that it is so clear that it's like such an action-orientated, grounded convergence, and like all the language and the programming feels really intentional and really vital, and to come away with like really important shared networks, I think is an incredible, important goal. And how can people attend, buy tickets, and what else should people know or bring into the space?
Yeah, so registrations are open. We really encourage people to register so we can get a gauge on numbers. And you can register through closepinegap.org.au. And you can send inquiries to closepinegap@proton.me, or reach out to either Umbantua for Palestine or Aman through our Instagram pages with any queries. The registration cost covers camping fees for 4 nights and food for the entire time. So it really is a bargain. All the kind of relevant information beyond that will be emailed out in an information pack for those who have registered.
Amazing. Yeah, we will have all of that in our show notes. And yeah, it's all available at Close Pine Gap. And we will, have all of that in our show notes and the tickets and links to the Instagram as well. But thank you so much, Anna, for coming on the show today and, really highlighting such an important convergence. And thank you for reaffirming and reinstating in all of our minds how important it is to Close Pine Gap, and Australia can't be complicit in that, especially not on sacred land. But thank you so much, Anna.
Thanks for having me. Hope to see you there.
Yeah, thank you. Bye.
Bye.
And that was Anna, an organiser with Wimpatwe for Palestine, one of the groups putting on the Close Pine Gap Sacred Land Back Convergence. It's an event that is inviting people from peace and anti-militarism movements across the continent this July 18th to 20th for 3 days of workshops, panels and actions that are weaving together anti-militarism and decolonial movements and trying to end Australia's complicity through sacred land in crimes of the US. So we'll have all of that in our show notes. You can also go to closedpinegap.org.au and links to registration and promotion will all be there as well. But yeah, we'll be right back with the last segment for our show.
We're celebrating 50 years of 3CR on Saturday the 4th of July at Collingwood Town Hall. There'll be stalls, displays, great food, performances, activities, prizes, and so much more. It's a birthday for us, and we can't wait to celebrate with you. Saturday the 4th of July, Collingwood Town Hall, 11 a.m. till 4 p.m. Bring your family, tell your friends, all are welcome. 3CR, celebrating 50 years.
Let us know you're coming. Go to Humanitix and search for 3CR to RSVP.
CR is about community, and we welcome your participation at the station.
3CR is open to a wide diversity of volunteers and is a great way to connect with Melbourne's activist community.
Have you ever thought about volunteering, doing a reception shift, getting a program on air,
training in radio skills, or contributing to one of the station's committees?
There are many ways to be involved at 3CR.
To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au and get in touch.
Don't have $1 million and still want to have a good education for your kid? Tune into the Dogs program. We are the defenders of government schools. 12 p.m. on Saturdays here on 3CR. 855 on the AM dial podcast, streaming live on 3cr.org.au and 3CR digital. We defend government schools because they need it.
CR is about community, and we welcome your participation at the station.
3CR is open to a wide diversity of volunteers and is a great way to connect with Melbourne's activist community.
Have you ever thought about volunteering, doing a reception shift, getting a program on air,
training in radio skills, or contributing to one of the station's committees?
There are many ways to be involved at 3CR.
To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au and get in touch.
Welcome back to 3CR Thursday Breakfast. It is the 4th of June. If you're just joining us, we have spoken about archival audio footage from Pinegrap protests in 2002. And thank you so much to Leela for editing and bringing that together. And then we heard from Raji Rage, a collaborative event that is coming up with Texter about... yeah, this beautiful creative survival within marginalised economies that is available on Thursday the 13th of August and Thursday the 20th. And we heard then from the Human Rights Law Centre about the NDIS whistleblower protections and how they are really lacking. And we heard from Anna about the Closed Pine Gap convergence in July the 18th to 20th, and registrations are open for that. And now, lastly, we are joined again by Christine Carolyn from Save Community Health, a non-politically affiliated grassroots community campaign to save public health. On the latest breaking news about CoHealth, the release of the long-awaited government-funded review of CoHealth. It is heavily redacted on the official HealthGov website, and originally it was said to be released in March of this year. We have still yet to receive the full report, but this redacted version is available 3 months later, but kind of with more questions than answers. We will briefly discuss the contents of the report, the recommendations, and what this tells us about next steps. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it's great to be back in this thing.
No worries. Christine, can you tell us a little bit more about... basically, what this is.
I'd love to, Inez.
It's so confusing.
It's pretty clear for us, I think, in Safe Community Health. On Tuesday of this week, there was a leak of the review report, and it was published on Health Services Daily, which is a website. And when the minister heard that, that the report was released but just summarised on Health Services Daily, Minister Butler, the federal health minister, said, no, the whole report should be released. And so yesterday afternoon we got 94 pages of the review, and it's a terrific report, Inez. I think you're right, it's that there are redactions, but the material that's there is very helpful for understanding what the problems are and what we might do to resolve them.
Yeah, thank you so much for outlining and how it's kind of come about. It sounds, yeah, it's interesting with, yeah, Minister Butler, with, you know, the changes to the NDIS, proposed changes, and having, yeah, wanting to be like, yeah, release the whole file package. But it's it's really important to know that the information of the government-funded review of CoHealth, it says so much about, yeah, what is needed. Can you tell us a little bit more about
the report? one thing I thought might be good for your listeners, Inez, was just this very initial piece that that is in the Health Services Daily from the report. What we will show in this report is that there are four factors that determine the viability of GP services run by CoHealth and like organisations. Two are external, the client base and the MBS funding model, and two are internal, the CoHealth model of care and CoHealth governance. So that's a terrific start for our community campaign, and also the City of Yarra, led by Steve Jolly, the mayor, is also launching a campaign around this. So it's very helpful to know those things. And there are a number of, there are recommendations in the report to the federal government, to the state government, and then quite telling recommendations to CoHealth about how they can lift their game. And I can say a few things about that if that's helpful.
Yes, please, that would be amazing. Yeah, then we'll go into more detail on the 18th of June. But, yeah, please tell us about these recommendations.
Yeah. So the report says that there has been inadequate governance and oversight by CoHealth. And it's in just one sentence that says, it's obvious in retrospect that CoHealth did not manage oversight of financial risks well. So that's a problem with the governance, the running of the board. But it also, another heading is poor management and inadequate oversight of clinics. And it goes into a fair bit of detail about how the CoHealth hasn't been managed. And it sums up that bit in the words from the report. CoHealth was therefore not meeting the management and financial management performance standard for community health centres. So that's, you know, the board and the senior management are not doing what they should have done, is what the report says.
Yeah, and the sky is blue, yeah.
Pardon?
Oh, yeah, I was like, yeah, and the sky is blue.
So it sort of tells us that we need to really look at the board and the senior management, and the, you know, the community meeting that you covered on your show a couple of weeks ago, that 150 people gathered at Fitzroy Town Hall and called for the board to resign and the senior management to be replaced. And I think this report actually reinforces in my mind that that's exactly what should happen. It's very tough to say that sort of thing to people who, you know, are good-hearted and probably want the best for services, but they haven't done the right thing and they haven't done it for years. And I think that a clean sweep is really needed. I think that's what our Safe Community Health group is saying.
Yeah, amazing. How do you think that the release of the government-funded review of the report is really helpful for, yeah, next steps to, yeah, get more information and more campaigning and more action.
Yeah, I think it's going to help us to be very strong about saying we need the board and the senior management to go, and then we need to grapple with those four elements that I read out at the beginning to, you know, that are within the purview of the government, and two, that are in the way that the organisation is run. And I think for your listeners, Inez, if they Google Save Community Health, they'll find their way to our newsletter and our website and regular reports, so that people can follow, as you just said, you know, how we're going to use this report to work towards a much stronger, much better running of services at Fitzroy, Collingwood and Kensington, and then how we might engage with the whole community health sector across Victoria.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah, we'll have all of that in our show notes on how to get involved and stay up to date with Save Community Health, and as well as, yeah, the links to the report and, yeah, how to join your newsletter and get in touch with you all. But thank you so much, Christine, for coming on the show again, and, yeah, just really keeping us updated on how important this is. But, yeah, I hope you have a really great day and such a monumental point, I guess, in the campaign for this to be released. Yeah.
Yeah, it was a really big one. And Inez, I want to thank you, because I think it's really important that 3CR has picked this up and is willing to keep going as the story unfolds. So thank you.
Oh, absolutely. I'm very passionate about saving co-health and making public health accessible and keeping it accessible in terms of location and cost. And it's such a vital part of the community, and I live there and have been a patient there, so it matters a lot to me and so many people.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Christine.
Good to work with you.
Oh, yeah. You too. I'll chat to you very soon. Hope you have a nice day.
Good on you. Thanks, Inez. Bye.
And that was Christine Carolyn from Save Community Health, a grassroots community-based campaign on the latest breaking news about co-health on the report that we have been waiting for has been released on the website, and it's a really, really vital part of the campaign. And we'll be right back with the rest of what we spoke about today.
The Electronic Intifada is Palestine's weapon of mass destruction.
Netanyahu's at the zenith of his genocidal career.
These people committed atrocities.
This is a war on children, essentially.
Tune into Electronic Intifada Radio for interviews, reports, and analysis Thursdays at 7 p.m. on 855 AM, 3CR Digital, and online at 3cr.org.au.
This is starvation. Time is running out.
3CR celebrating 50 years.
Throughout the month of June, we're asking you to support fierce, independent and community-controlled media by making a donation to our Radiothon.
We'll be taking donations online, over the phone and in the station to help keep 3CR going for another year.
To donate, go to 3cr.org.au, call the station on 03 9419 8377
or drop in at 21 Smith Street, Fitzroy during business hours.
3CR, celebrating 50 years.
This is Thursday Breakfast, and we are celebrating 50 years of 3CR, and our show today, I think, has been a really good example of the work that 3CR has been doing and the kinds of voices that 3CR has been platforming for the past 50 years. And first of all, that was actually some archival audio, and I did the maths 24 years ago. We heard some of the special broadcasts from 2002 Pine Gap Peace Camp protests. And after that, we heard from a local artist, Raju Rage, who is doing a project in collaboration with another local artist, Texter Queen. And Texter actually first spoke on 3CR, I think it was 12 years ago, in a panel discussion about intersectionality and feminism. Sign up to their workshop
submit that by Wednesday, the 10th of June, if you'd like to participate. Then we heard from Madeline Howe from Human Rights Law Centre. And after that, we heard from Mpantwe for Falastin. And finally, you heard from Kristen Carolyn from Save Community Health. Thank you so much for being with us this morning. And we hope to continue giving you our independent content. And think about donating to our Radiothon. Bye.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton. You can buy books online and keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.